Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
And we had a little bit of a glitch last week with the website. It went down for about, what was it, maybe 10 hours or so?
Oh, that one.
Yeah, it was the 10 hours that we were asleep, so it was kind of hard to notice. But yeah, it's good news, though. We exceeded our bandwidth, which means we're getting more popular. So thank you for everybody for visiting our website. And yeah, sorry that you couldn't for a little bit.
But trying to visit.
Well, trying to visit. Thank you for trying to visit.
But it's all fixed now, so it should be fine.
That's good. So there were three new D&D Next articles that came out that just more polls for us to take. So the article said that, you know, people have been saying that fighters are kind of boring and they're looking for more options to do during combat. And the mechanic they came up with sounds like, I think it was like a prestige class in 3.5 where the rogue had an ability where he could sort of trade sneak attack damage dice for an extra effect. Because that kind of sounds like what they're doing. They're going to give the fighter a pool of dice that's going to sort of vary in size and die type as the fighter advances. And they only gave sort of brief examples, nothing concrete, but supposedly you're going to be able to spend those dice for different effects, such as adding a die to your to-hit roll, or adding a die from this pool to your damage roll, or sort of spending a die to get an extra attack. So,
yeah. Sounds pretty cool. Like, it sounds like an interesting mechanic.
Yeah, it does sound a little bit interesting. It also sounds like it doesn't really fit the game.
Yeah. You brought that up the other day, and I was thinking about it. It does seem really clunky. Like, I was really impressed with the first playtest because everything seems pretty streamlined and fits well together, but this really does have the kind of feeling of just being tacked on, because it is, but...
Yeah. No, we mentioned, I think it was in the last episode, about Robert J. Schwab being brought on. He was doing a lot of work with D&D prior, but now he's left Green Ronin. And it kind of sounds like the stuff that was that comes out of Green Ronin, like these,
right.
Like a Dragon Age with the stunt die, the specialty die that you get in a Song of Ice and Fire role playing, and those kind of things. But the differences in those games, everything is kind of built around these dice pools. Like Wayne brought up, it sounded like Marvel Heroic role playing, and again, that's all built around dice pools and different size die.
Yeah.
So this sounds like a great mechanic that's being tacked on to a game with just a different style and flavor.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is gonna make it seem, more clunky than it would otherwise. And Wayne brought up a good point. It means that people are gonna have to like learn a different set of rules when they play different characters.
Like I like the mechanic. It feels very similar, as we said, to Marvel Heroic role playing or the dice pool systems. If it's not carried across to the other classes, or if this is the only place you see it, then as we just said, it will feel clunky and tacked on, and rather than like a coherent whole, you'll have to learn a new set of rules for each class rather than all being sort of similar. I mean, there is one other dice pool mechanic in the rules currently. The hit dice can kind of be looked at as a die pool that you can use for resource management. But that might actually go away, because the other feedback they've gotten is we don't like healing. So that mechanic could go away, and then you would only have that one fighter die pool.
I don't think it's that big a deal to have to learn some new rules when you learn a new character. If you haven't played a wizard before, then the whole Vancian magic system is really going to throw you for a loop, I'm sure. And like you mentioned, the rogue in some previous editions had a very similar kind of die pool mechanic. The thing gets me is that I don't know how clunky it's going to be in the end. They may smooth that out a lot, but the way that they presented it to the audience is clunky in and of itself. Like, I was thinking with the new the new D&D Next rules, if they had presented it to me piecemeal like they're doing now, like, I would have totally been against it, you know? No skills? What's going on? But when I got the whole package, it looked really good. Same thing with this now. I'm just kind of getting these little hints of what might be coming. I'd prefer to see a more refined product.
Yeah, no, I agree. It does seem like they're just kind of throwing stuff at the problem.
Mm.
So people are saying fighters are boring. They're like, all right, how about this? This is kind of has some razzmatazz. I think you're probably saying exactly what the listeners are thinking. Yeah, but if you play a wizard, you got to learn Vancian magic. And if you play a cleric, you've got to learn their divine magic system. So all of them have like extra rules tacked on, but the kind of like what they do with the dice is all similar.
Mm.
And because this maybe it's because this mechanic is built around dice that it does seem like it's a bigger departure than the other ones.
Yeah.
But then I guess it also highlights that, and maybe that's why people are saying fighters are boring, is they don't seem like they have extra rules.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, you know, I understand. I fighters more interesting and giving them more options. I love that in 3.5.
Yeah, those little feet trees.
Because I do like those trees. I like, for example, in Twilight Imperium 3, I like playing the tech guys trees, because I like to spend most of the game just doing the tech and people attack me like, whoa. Working on a tree here. Working on a tree.
Wait until I'm done on my tech. Then you can attack me.
Wait till I get the Uber fighters.
Yeah.
So I really enjoy that part of the game. As a lot of it, though, is, I guess, passive or automatic. So maybe it might feel like you're not making a lot of choices when you're actually in combat because it all, like, you know, triggers automatically.
Oh, I was going to say, they have the two D20s going on there, so they could probably play with something with that. But
yeah. Oh, absolutely.
For advantage and disadvantage, yeah. Hmm. I guess one of the other things, like, it's not really a problem. It's kind of, if we see it in play, I'm wondering how it will play. I noticed that the fighter's die pool refreshes every turn. And if the idea is you can spend these dice for different tactical options to make the play more interesting, I'm wondering how interesting will it be when the die pool goes back to your maximum every turn. Are people just going to do the same action, turn after turn after turn?
Like the max. It's like,
well, this is the most like effective action. Exactly. This is the most effective action, so I'm going to do this again. What are you going to do? I'm going to spend it on damage again. Where I almost, and again, there's no specifics, but I almost wish they made it per encounter. Because I feel that limiting choices or having a lot of options but only a small number of resources to do those options would make the choices meaningful. You know, like I kind of likened it before to Space Hulk, right? The Terminators only get so many action points a turn, and you want to do everything, but you can't. And that makes it interesting, and your choices are meaningful, and it makes it kind of tense and exciting. And again, I don't know how this combat superior dice pool will work, but it seems like you're going to be able to kind of do everything you want turn after turn after turn.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Well, maybe. We've only got, like, very, very sketchy examples of what it is, so it's hard to really make any kind of judgments on it.
Right.
I guess at the core, though, when people are saying fighters are boring, you almost want to say, well, what did you expect?
Yeah.
So somebody who has the ability to turn into a bird or can turn, like, you know, create water out of thin air, can, you know, open rifts in, you know, time and space, versus a guy that swings a sword. You're like, yeah, I guess he could seem a little bit boring. What did you expect? You wanted to play him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, can't my sword? No, it can't. Can it open rifts? No, it can't.
You play a sword mage.
Yeah.
I've always thought that the fighter fills a certain role. There is a certain kind of player who doesn't really care for special theatrics or anything. They just want to go in combat and say, okay, I roll over and over. And I think that is a kind of player that the fighter suits.
I enjoy playing fighters, but I tend to enjoy playing fighters not so much because of what they do in combat, but the role they play outside of combat.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of the stories are surround, you know, the fighter is at the, it's the knight, the fighter, and the wizard is a kind of the sidekick or the mentor. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that, because there's a certain romance behind the fighter or behind the knight that you just don't get with a wizard a lot of times. And that's why I'll play them, is to capture that romance, not because I expect to be able to do super amazing things in combat. I expect to be efficient.
Yeah.
And if I say something like, well, I jump on the table or I swing on the chandelier, and that's fine, you know. But you don't necessarily need a dice pool to do that. So, I don't know. I think we're seeing a lot of, like, pendulum. It'll keep swinging, you know. Which one do you like? And
you know, speaking of which one do you like, the other article was Orcs and Gnolls by James Wyatt. And it was essentially the thought process that goes behind creating a style guide or a style sheet for an IP. And what they did is they said, hey, we're going to look at orcs and gnolls, and here's a write-up of orcs and kind of how we envision them, and here's a write-up of gnolls and how we envision them. And then there was a poll asking, does the write-up of orcs we provided feel like D&D orcs? And you could rate it from 1 to 5, you know, 1 being none at all, 5 being something ridiculous.
Like the paragon of orcs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And they did the same thing for gnolls. And I looked at that and I said, why are you asking?
You should also say that if people haven't read the article, and please do, there is nothing radical.
Yes.
There is nothing different. So you know the orc that you've had for the previous four editions?
Yeah,
that's what they wrote up. And you're like, okay, so you know what an orc is. Like, what kind of reaction? And wrote up the gnoll, and it was like an A to Z of what a gnoll is.
And you're like, wow, that's
all. Head,
yeah,
dog.
All four previous edition of the orcs and all four previous edition of the gnolls. Great, yeah.
Yeah.
So for me, yeah, it kind of felt like a pointless poll, because anyone who says, no, that's not a D&D orc, it's almost like they could whip out editions 4 through 1, you know, and say, look, well, right here, we mined all these previous books for this, so you can't tell us it's not a D&D orc.
Copy-paste.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it felt like. It felt like copy-paste. So why are you asking if it feels like, you know, a D&D monster? Yeah. So, yeah, there wasn't anything radical or different. And I almost thought, rather than start with these very iconic monsters, why not start with a monster that's maybe not so iconic? Or why not put out a poll that says, what monster felt out of place? What didn't feel like D&D? Or something else, something different? Because, again, no one's going to argue that the orcs and gnolls you've presented are not D&D, I don't think.
Yeah, and then the art director followed up
with his
own article about drawing the gnoll.
Yeah, and again, it was his thought process of what goes into creating a style guide and kind of reimagining the gnolls, and they had, you know, pictures of all the gnolls from previous editions, concept sketches where they were kind of playing around with body shapes, and then sort of the final artwork. And again, another poll that said, do you like the gnoll? Yes or no? And then there was...
How are we doing?
That's what it felt like, and that's kind of really rubbing me the wrong way. It feels like they're asking for a head pat and a little doggy treat with every step they take.
No, it sounds like they just passed it to him. It's your turn to write the blog post this week.
Well, that too.
I disagree. I think, because James Wyatt wrote the first that first article. It's like, here's an orc and here's a gnoll, and you're kind of reading it, you know, a little bit surprised, because this is the guy who wrote the 4E Dungeon Master's Guide. And whatever you think about 4E D&D, that Dungeon Master's Guide is one of the best of all of the editions. The way it was very easy to follow. You could see a new Dungeon Master really finding that a valuable tool.
Mm.
So this guy knows how to write, and he knows his business. So to see him writing like a dead obvious orc and a dead obvious gnoll with nothing radical, nothing changed, and said, does this seem like an orc to you? You're like, are you for real? So I think they've gotten some directive from Hasbro that says, you know, you have to constantly poll everybody. So what he's doing, he's following the letter of the directive, but he's not following the spirit. So it's kind of like, well, you know, kind of F you. Here's your poll. Yo, everybody love the orc because it's the same, you know. Yeah. Everybody love that gnoll because it's the same. And even these pictures, I mean, if you had taken maybe some of the concept sketch art, which some of them looked a bit rough, but if you took they were showing all the gnoll through all the editions, and if you took all those pictures plus the new one they have and put it in the same book, you know, like a book of gnolls, no one would say, oh, there's too much variation here. It would look like someone's slight take on the gnoll, because they all look the same. It was like they all had hyena heads, they're all humanoids.
They all look kind of dangerous.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. And one of the things was, do they look like a demon worshiper enough?
Yeah.
Like, all right.
I actually, that was a coffee table book. The Book of Gnolls.
The Book of Gnolls. Well, it's a really radical departure here. No, it wasn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's like one of them looked beefier than the other. You know, but you could see that variation in people. Like, whoa, what kind of concept art went in here?
Well, that guy's not a person. Look at how big he is.
Now, what style guy was he going from? So now we move on to our next creature feature, and this one is going to be femme fatale. So those who listen to bankers and gangsters, you realize that when we do creature feature, we don't always necessarily do
creatures.
Or ever.
And we've done them sometimes.
Yeah, we have done giants. And werewolves.
Let's be talking about a femme fatale gnoll.
Yeah. It was a hyena head. We probably should get it out of the way just with the femme fatale. Some people find the femme fatales a bit misogynistic, but we think they're a classic a character that you can include in your game. Certainly a classic characters in stories and figures in history. So we think that it's definitely worth exploring. Why creature feature? Because the structure is perfect for the femme fatale. So what we're going to look at is classic femme fatales in history and fiction. And then we're going to look at playing them as both a protagonist and then an antagonist. So to kick it off, let's look at femme fatales in history and fiction. So who are the iconic femme fatales? Not necessarily your personal favorites, but who are the iconic ones that everyone should know?
I kind of think the quintessential femme fatale, I think I'm going to butcher this name, would be Margaretha Gertrudia Zell, also known as Mata Hari.
Yeah, the easier name.
Yeah.
And the one everybody knows.
Yeah.
You should have just left it at Margarita Gazelle. And I was like, ooh.
No, because I think she probably had a lot of influence on the image of the femme fatale. Because she was like a Dutch exotic dancer in the early 1900s and then was a German spy during World War I. So sort of her notoriety comes from being this sort of extremely risque exotic dancer in Paris.
Yeah.
With costumes that would probably maybe even rival Janet Jackson, even now.
Well, since one of her costumes is just jewelry and a bra, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And you kind of have that image. It was almost...
Sorry, Janet Jackson. Why is she the...
I thought of wardrobe malfunction.
Oh, okay. But you know, that was a malfunction.
Well,
it's not like she's like, so poor Janet Jackson getting slammed here.
Oh, all right.
Like she's a bigger hoe than Janet Jackson. That's what it sounds like.
All right, I was not implying that. Just the word of malfunction is the first thing that popped in my head. Okay.
Okay. We of course are. Oh, I can't say I'm a big fan of Janet Jackson's music, I just don't think she should.
Anyway, the other thing I think she had an effect on was this sort of stage persona she had, mm-hmm. sort of played into the fascination with mysticism and Orientalism at the time. She actually mm-hmm. sort of had like a fake background of coming from the Dutch East Indies. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, even the name Mata Hari kind of has this Indian sounding name, even though she wasn't. And whether it's true or not, I think that's what has sort of shaped the quote unquote like exotic cast that most femme fatales have or you see a lot in literature and movies and media now.
Well, she definitely has some of the classic femme fatale cliches or characteristics, the sexuality, also the mystery. Hmm. Yeah, when she was executed in 1917, it was still unclear whether or not she was a spy.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it was a bit of a mystery, like, oh, maybe they killed an innocent woman. Hmm. I was later revealed that she actually was a German spy,
right.
But that was like decades later.
Yeah.
So she had that, plus, yeah, again, the sexuality. And something else, and this is going to come up with a few of them, is like, hey, you see some pictures? Yeah, she's all right looking.
Yeah.
But she's not a ravishing beauty. But it's not so much that they're beautiful. Like, the femme fatale doesn't necessarily have to be beautiful. It's that they just know how to use their sexuality in a certain way that can drive men crazy.
Yeah.
They know how to work it.
Yeah.
Work it, girl. Yeah. Not even said that she was like a courtesan, and even in the thing I read about her, it said she wasn't really known for being this classic beauty as other sort of courtesans of the time were. It was kind of like her sensuality, or almost like raw sexuality, that kind of gave her that position.
Willingness to do things, maybe.
Maybe, I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah.
Or the apparent willingness to do things.
Uh-huh, yeah. You know, she gave her kids syphilis? Her and her husband?
Yeah, I read that too.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty nasty. Terrible. What's the word I'm looking for? Oh, terrible. Yeah. How about you, Chris? Who has kind of stood out in your mind when we decided to do femme fatale?
Well, I went with definitely some more modern versions, but from the fictional one. But Jessica Rabbit, I thought, from Who Framed Roger Rabbit, is pretty good epitome of one. And also Catwoman as well, Selina Kyle.
Just a little bit of whiplash there.
Well, they are both cartoon characters, so there's your link.
Yeah, yeah. No, they had a link, but then Madhari to Jessica Rabbit. Yeah. What is it about them that makes them... I agree. I think... I deliberately did not write down...
You agree exactly like one of those Wizards of the Coast polls. Yes, those are femme fatales. Can you disagree? No, I can't. All right, then.
I rate you 5. Well, like Jessica Rabbit, I mean, she was made as a caricature of the whole film noir and femme fatale figure, so obviously she fits well into it. You know, she was stunningly sexy. She knew, for a cartoon, she knew how to use men and play different people off of each other for it. She talked the talk and walked the walk of the film noir style. Intelligent, skillful, all that good stuff.
And voiced by Kathleen Turner,
hmm.
Who's been in at least one movie as a femme fatale. I think Body Heat.
Yeah, I was going to say, Jessica Rabbit also kind of has the thing that I guess I didn't really, well, maybe kind of mentioned with Manohara, is that you never really are entirely clear in what her motivations are.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, you're not really clear, you know, is she a suspect? Well, she is a suspect, but, you know, is she a victim or is she kind of the person who committed the crime?
That's a good point.
You're not really sure. This kind of...
She's not bad. She's just drawn that way.
All right, thank you.
Great line, that.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot better when Kathleen Turner said it.
Oh, sorry.
Put on some more sultry, Lyle.
Whenever I watch that movie now, it's going to be your voice. Thanks.
That's so weird. And my head on there. Why is that? The problem's you, Wayne.
I've never watched that movie again.
Yeah, and why Catwoman? Why did...
Well, Catwoman, more than Jessica Rabbit, because Jessica Rabbit... in the fiction, in the story, was actually more of a red herring than an actual classical femme fatale. Narratively, Catwoman fits it so well. I mean, she's alluring and mysterious, so the protagonist is drawn to her, but she's also very dangerous. You know, she's never on the right side of the law, but, you know, sometimes she goes allies with Batman to go against the bad guys, but sometimes she's just using him. You never know where she stands, and she is his weak point.
Really?
That's not kryptonite.
Well, I know it's not kryptonite. I knew you were going to work in a Superman reference somewhere in there.
It's in my contract.
How do I... Lois Lane? No. Is she femme fatale? Well, it reminds me of the... just saying, you mentioning Superman, reminds me of the comic story Hush, and Superman's in that, and Poison Ivy uses her, like kisses him and controls Superman. So she's another femme fatale.
Right. Mm. There's actually kind of a lot in Batman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost every female character.
There's Harley Quinn as well. Harley Quinn.
I was trying to decide whether Harley Quinn would be a femme fatale or not, because, again, this is a bit semantic, but I imagine that the femme fatale would kind of have to understand what she's doing, where you get or at least I get the impression that Harley Quinn is kind of not all there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes and no. I mean, there's a couple times when, like, she's gotten pissed off at the Joker, so she'll go against him, in which case she shows herself to be really, really intelligent.
Hmm.
So it's kind of like she's just playing dumb, but in most of the episodes, she's just kind of a second fiddle to the Joker. So,
but she's always intelligent. It's like the Joker's crazy, but you would say he's a mastermind.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you certainly got a flaw. And there's nothing to say that a femme fatale can't be crazy.
But she doesn't use him. He uses her. So
the Joker?
Yeah,
but I guess... it raises an interesting point, a femme fatale as a weapon, as opposed to femme fatale as a kind of a character on its own.
Right.
You know, or as a tool.
If you have a bad person who's just plainly an antagonist, but there also kind of fits that, like, sexy female role in that, is that really a femme fatale or not? Because it could just be a sexy villain, you know? The mystique, as Wayne said, is what's important, I think.
I think we said, like, you kind of... you never really know what her true or clear motivations are.
Mm-hmm.
And Harley Quinn, yeah, even though she can, you know, leave, or she leaves a Joker sometimes, she's on that side most of the time, which I think kind of pushes her to villain.
Yeah.
Rather than femme fatale. It's not like Catwoman, who will, you know, kind of waffle back and forth or walk that line.
I think a femme fatale can be clearly a villain. I think the key is unclear to the people they're interacting with.
Okay.
Yes, their motivations. Very good point, Lyle.
It's not necessarily, like, when she tries to help people, it might be clear to you as the viewer that she's trying to get back at the Joker because they had a fight. Mm-hmm. But it might be unclear to Batman or whoever she's trying to help, why is she trying to do this? I mean, he can, you know, smart guy, maybe he can connect the dots.
Right.
But then there's always that hope that she'll stay.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, moving on from Batman, I guess another iconic one, I go back to history, is Cleopatra. Again, well, there's questions of whether or not just how beautiful she was, because there's different reports that she was absolutely stunning. Some saying, yeah, she's good looking, but she was able to ensnare Julius Caesar. Although there was with a massive assist from her brother. Whoa, that thing came out wrong. So her brother allowed Pompey the Great to be killed, thinking that would put him in good stead with Julius Caesar. And of course, I had the opposite reaction because you just don't kill, you know, a great Roman, even if you have a disagreement. So Cleopatra took advantage of that and that anger. But once she met Julius Caesar, instead of annexing Egypt, he decided to like support her claim to the throne. So she was able to use what she had, which was at the, you know, you think about a woman at that time, it's like what you have is what you see, to ensnare Julius Caesar. And they had a son together. Then after that, her and Mark Antony, of course, when you watch the movie Cleopatra, that's who Richard Burton played. Elizabeth Taylor played Cleopatra. And that was tragic. That did not end well.
Mm. Yeah, I read that there was some debate about whether it was actually snake poison that killed her.
Oh, yeah, it didn't end well for her either.
Yeah, yeah.
I was actually thinking Mark Antony first.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, man, look at the misogynist here. Yeah. So I think that's really good, because if you follow her history, you can see a femme fatale interacting, of course, with real people because she's a real person in history, but definitely on the high levels of power and what they can do and how they can manipulate things that way. So if you look at Mata Hari, she's, yeah, definitely iconic, but she's interacting with the, you know, lesser, like, yeah, sure, some soldiers and politicians and that, but not the absolute leaders. Yeah. And of course, there's a classic, I don't know if it's true or not, but she was wrapped herself up in the carpet, and then that got enrolled at Caesar's feet. So, you know, because you have to think, well, how am I going to get past the guards and things like that?
How are we going to make a grand entrance?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. How are you going to make that statement?
I read that it was bed sheets, actually, not a carpet.
You always got to contradict me, Chris.
Bed sheets, carpet. It's something that made a roll and wasn't a blue carpet.
Did they unroll it?
Could have been a burrito for all we know.
She was in a giant tortilla.
Yeah, she's not bad, but I like my burritos. And one, you know, I guess I did watch this movie as a kid, called The Vampire Lovers. It was on TV one day, late at night. Because it's about lesbian vampires. Yeah. You can obviously see why I stayed up. And that's based on the novel Carmilla, which is actually older than Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another a good example. Of course, it's a lot of supernatural aspects, but for fictional femme fatale, definitely Carmilla, and forming a relationship with this girl named Laura. And there's also, because it is about lesbians, that we generally imagine the femme fatale seducing men, but here we have an example of the femme fidèle. Gore Vidal died today.
Yeah. Wow. That was my little,
yeah, it's my little homage to Gore Vidal. Yeah.
Yeah, Freudian slip.
Yeah. Femme fatale. Where was I? okay, yes, yeah, seducing a woman. Yeah.
One of the interesting things I kind of found out.
You know who Gord Vidal would never seduce? A woman.
All right. Now, you mentioning supernatural kind of made me think of doing the research for this. Sort of the femme fatale in early literature is kind of akin to like a witch or a succubus or sort of one of those like female evil spirits who are obviously supernatural. And that kind of got so ingrained in sort of the image of a femme fatale that kind of carried over to the almost the knockout gas or sort of the little mechanical tricks that femme fatales are supposed to have used or are shown in media using in kind of like modern era. This kind of almost like modern supernatural power
yeah.
to overcome men, mostly.
Wow, you know, I mean, you think you go back to the beginning of recorded history, if you... It's not really the beginning of recorded history, but if you look back in the Bible, and like Lilith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading that. What do you think about Eve, too?
As a femme fidèle?
Yeah, you love saying femme fidèle. As a Gore Vidal?
Sorry, as a femme fidèle?
Yeah, in Christian mythology, she's often referred to as like an example of sexual temptation, of giving in to evil.
Hmm.
I don't know, just food for thought.
Yeah, I can see that being a good example where that would make people play up the misogyny. You know, saying that, it's like...
I was trying to find a way to say that, yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those things, it's like a way of demonizing... maybe demonizing is the wrong word to use, but putting women in their place and using that as an excuse to explain their inferior role.
Oh, yeah. Actually, as I was reading about it, there was some preacher, in part of his speech, was he yelled to all the women in the church to say, you are the portal to all evil. So, yeah, it's definitely a very misogynist part of mythology.
And I suppose Lilith as well. I mean, certainly anybody who's read vampire fiction in the last couple of decades would see that people have really embraced that and saying that she's like the originator of the vampire and things like that. Even World of Darkness, when they have Cain, still she plays a role in that.
Yeah, the first
True
vampire.
Blood, they make her the first.
Hmm.
Yeah. And True Blood also has another, in season 5, they introduce a femme fatale, Salome, classic, Dance of the Seven Veils.
John the Baptist's head. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's from the New Testament, and then people like Oscar Wilde. Hey, we are bringing up Oscar Wilde.
Yeah, and linking back to old episodes, Lilith was one of the top deities looked to in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
Yep. In Cleopatra, we had somebody who was of royal blood, but in a weak position, comparatively, for being someone who's supposed to be in charge of a country or a kingdom, and then using what she has to maintain her power or to reclaim her power. I think in Salome, you have an example. I guess she's the stepdaughter of the king, but you have somebody very young. And what does... A young person is maybe not that smart. Maybe they're cunning, but they've got their youth. I mean, youth adds like levels of attractiveness, especially to somebody who's old.
And a perv.
Yeah.
Yeah, that always helps.
And you know, although when you're using that in the game, you might feel a little bit uncomfortable doing that, especially if somebody's underage or a character is underage. But that is, if you're playing a mature game with mature players, I think that is something that you could explore.
In this case, read mature as pedophile.
I didn't mean she was like 8.
I meant
16, 15 or something.
You know, it brings up the good point that the femme fatale character, they don't have to be sexy, as you guys both said. You know, they can use all different manners of their powers and their intelligence, which they should. I mean, they can use people's lust for greed, for revenge, their gullibility. They can even use a hero's own heroism after him. I'm just a poor defenseless woman. Please help me. All of it's up for grabs.
Yeah.
Yeah, so your next character, femme fatale, charisma 3. There you go.
Yeah. Good luck.
Give it a shot, you know.
I was going to say, in the Salome story, there's different interpretations or different versions of it, and you could almost say that Salome's mother was the femme fatale, because in certain stories, the mother tells Salome, okay, you know, the king's going to ask you for a present, tell him you want this.
Yeah.
And she's almost kind of the tool. You know, but not really the manipulator behind the scenes in certain versions.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, and this is used in True Blood, whereas the person who is the femme fatale can present themselves as the victim in a situation. So you're like, oh, maybe you're not to blame. And then that helps to maintain the mystery. And somebody who's of a certain demographic where they are typical victims, and, you know, again, back to a young, very young person, then it makes it that much easier for them to switch in and out. It's like, well, no, I'm so young. What do I know about the world?
Yeah. I think that's like a classic trope. I mean, those detective noir stories, right? Mm-hmm. The femme fatale walks in the door, and she's usually the one presenting herself as being in trouble or being in a bind. Or
the abusive boyfriend.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
In those cases, she could either be acting as if she's the victim, or she could actually be one, and it's just kind of trying to essentially use that position of nothing to kind of, you know, leverage something out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, or you could do it both. You know, she is the victim, but she's not pure by any means. She's out to get revenge.
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, like Morgan Le Fay is a good example of that. Somebody where she's, I guess, the stepdaughter of Uther Pendragon, and he kind of kicks her off. Mm-hmm. But then she always wants to get revenge on her half-brother, Arthur. And just following that. And yeah, that's a good example. And of course, she's using like her lovers and that to, one example, to try to get Excalibur to kill Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then sets up Arthur to die. And here, like, Arthur did nothing to her.
Hmm.
In a sense, but he's now the surrogate for Uther Pendragon.
Well, he did do something. Mm-hmm. He was born. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Yeah. But I think if anybody was planning to run a femme fatale, my number one recommendation is to rent the movie The Last Seduction with Linda Fiorentino. Blanks.
Yeah, yeah. Set it up. Give a little bit of background.
All right. Well, it's it was made in the early 90s, and I think it aired on HBO cable. It aired on cable first, and they think one of the reasons why she didn't get nominated for an Oscar is because one of the rules is it has to air in the theater first.
Hmm.
So if something airs on TV, you're disqualified from being nominated for an Oscar, and it did get a theatrical release afterwards. But it has some of the best lines, which unfortunately I can't say because of our non-explicit
policy.
Language policy. But great lines, great character, has you guessing until the end. And this is a really good example of somebody who can play a very harsh, strong woman, but still it's unclear how much of a victim she is. She doesn't have to be all helpless and everything. You see this person is very capable, very smart, but what's the real motivation? And it's a really good movie. It has Peter Berg, who went on to direct and make Friday Night Lights. And, of course, we're a fan club of three, but Battleship.
Hmm.
and he's great in it. And it's great finding out, like, his secrets. So it was a bunch of secrets, and people who bag Bill Pullman, they might enjoy watching him in this. He actually gives a really good performance.
Hmm.
But yeah, that's The Last Seduction, and it strong recommendation there. And I think you could, not only would you get a good idea of how to play a really interesting femme fatale, but you would also understand how to kind of set up the plans and the schemes, but also kind of how to run a film noir.
Hmm.
Yeah. So that's my recommendation. Another one, it's less so, it's a Gus Van Sant film, but it's a good film, is To Die For with Nicole Kidman and Matt Damon.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's Joaquin Phoenix's, if not his first role, but his first major role. And it's about a woman. You've seen this a lot. It's becoming so common now, like teachers sleeping with their their kids. But, you know, an older woman manipulating a younger man to do, not nice things. I don't want to spoil it, but
yeah,
it's a really well-done film. And it's really good just to, you know, follow, like, her motivations and what she wants in life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's less mystery there, as because we're the outsider, but you can certainly see how the other characters can't see what she's really like. But then she also makes her a more sympathetic character.
I think that's something definitely to take away if you're going to be, like, the GM or the storyteller in a game where one of the PCs is a femme fatale. It's that, and I failed miserably at this. When I was running Changeling, it's like when someone sets up a plan, allow it to work.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, just because you as the GM can kind of, you're the outsider, you can kind of see what's going on. The people involved in the plan can't, you know. So I'm not saying make the NPCs dumb, but kind of try and play them as, you know, they only have the information that they would see, which isn't going to be a lot.
Well, I think that it's a good lead-in into playing the femme fatale as a protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think one of the big things about them is they have plans.
Mm.
Whether it's Cleopatra, Mata Hari, Linda Fiorentino in The Last Seduction, or Catwoman, they have some idea or some plan, something that they want. How do you make these plans work, or how do you help your players as a game master with these plans?
Well, I think as a player, I think at least a place to start is with kind of a strong backstory, or at least a backstory that has story hooks that the GM can you know, sort of pull on, or even just motivations for your character. I mean, it sounds easy to say, and like, hey, how do you make a plan? Have your character want something.
Mm.
You know, doesn't sound like all that profound advice, but that's probably the best thing to do, because even if it's like a big motivation or something big your character wants, your GM can then sort of build that into the game world or the scenario or the situation so that you would be involved and that you would try and go after this thing. And basically, they're giving you the chance to come up with a plan to get this thing that you want.
Yeah, and don't be afraid to go grandiose with it. The femme fatales, it's usually not a simple goal. It's something that takes a lot of work. Cleopatra wanted to run an entire nation, as an example.
Yeah. Well, I guess, like, going grandiose, and I guess it kind of goes a little bit in the Black Marketeer episode we talked about. The character is possibly going to come up with a plan that has a lot of steps and involve interacting with a lot of people. And I think to facilitate that, the GM is going to kind of have to at least help set that up a little bit. You know, it's not, you kind of don't go directly for the end goal, right? First you go over to like this person and then you kind of get a little bit of information that you can sell to another person to get some more information. And it's kind of an elaborate plan, which the GM has to sort of help you set up. You basically have to sort of break down what you want. You almost have to have like a currency that you can spend to get to the end goal a little bit.
You know, I was thinking about that. I wasn't thinking of the word currency, but I think that's a good way to phrase it, is that you also need to, I mean, we've talked about the plan, but also just getting down to the basics and what's on your character sheet is things that help them with their manipulation and that, obviously. As we said, you don't have to be ravishingly beautiful. Actually, you don't even have to be a woman.
Hmm.
You can be a man. Yeah. Something that...
From now, would that be?
Homme fatale?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Pretty boy.
Yeah. You don't even have to be pretty. But you've got to be a manipulator. No, you know, sorry, a little bit off topic, or actually not off topic, a little bit of a sidetrack. But the homme fatale still needs to use their sexuality or that kind of magnetism. We see a good example in the TV series Prophet. Well, I guess some people have seen it. Most people haven't seen it. That is a good example. Here we have Adrian Pastar playing a guy named Prophet, who has some goals. It's actually not 100% clear what his goals are to the viewer. It's a bit of a mystery. But it's clear that he has them, and he has plans and schemes. And sometimes he needs to use his sexuality and his magnetism in order to get what he wants. So that's a really good example to see how to play an homme fatale.
Hmm.
You brought up, Wayne, that it would probably have a lot of other characters in it. And that's something that the GM should be aware of. If there's someone looking to play a femme fatale or a homme lethal, maybe, in the game, please expect that there be a lot of NPCs in it. Because for the femme fatale, people are their weapons.
Yeah, essentially. I was going to say, like, building the character, yeah, you'd probably have either whatever your system needs for, like, manipulation or bluff or perform or carousing streetwise, you know, all these sort of interaction skills. And if the GM doesn't provide people for you to interact with, they're essentially hamstringing your character. You've put points in this and now you can't really use it. But I think you brought up a good point, Lyle, is that whether you're playing a femme fatale or an homme fatale,
I think homme lethal.
Or homme lethal, yeah, thanks. You have to use your sexuality. Because otherwise, I don't know why, like, you think of...
You're just a manipulator.
Exactly, you're just a manipulator. Like, anybody can just kind of go in and beat information out of someone. We wouldn't call that person a femme fatale or an homme lethal, right?
Yeah.
There kind of has to be that, I was going to say sexual manipulation a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it also requires a lot of buy-in from the other people around the table. I mean, it's really easy to say just no to some dude sitting across the table from you. But, you know, it's not as easy to say it to a gorgeous woman. So... people have to play along.
Yeah, I guess you could look at it when you're looking at a party, and I know we've referenced this TV series a number of times, but The Leverage, and they do have the actress character who oftentimes needs to play something, you know, like kind of a PG femme fatale.
Yeah, like while we were doing research, I almost was considering putting her in as an example, but I kind of decided not to. Because the show kind of has to say PG.
I would say, and actually, she's not a true femme fatale, and that's not what her character is. But a lot of times, she's asked to play a certain role within an episode, which would be like a femme fatale. Mm. But that would be a good example of how you can have, well, she's not necessarily manipulating the other people around her.
Mm-hmm.
The other player characters.
Right.
They understand what she is and what she can do. So they're working with her.
Mm-hmm.
That might be, I guess, as the relationship between Batman and Catwoman evolves, is maybe that's a bad example because I don't think he ever doesn't truly trust her in many respects, but I don't think he uses her as a tool.
Right.
Mm.
But maybe she'll go off and do it and help him out, I suppose.
That's a good example, though, of a way to include a femme fatale in a group of other players, though.
Well, I never really assumed that the femme fatale would actually be trying to manipulate the other PCs.
You
know? No. I always kind of saw, you know, this character as, yeah, you're part of a team, and just your skill set is interacting with people and getting information,
But it's more like if you were playing, we've done that, like when we play Hollow Death Expedition, one of your characters, Becky, is attractive and can sometimes use, and again, this is another G-rated femme fatale, is, you know, playing the kind of the helpless victim to kind of, you know, get somebody to drop their guard. But because there's not that overt sexuality or there's not a lot of mystery, really, that she's not really a femme fatale. She's just a female character who's outsmarting people.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think they're... I suppose they have to have a little bit of a dark side. I'm not saying that sexuality is dark and wrong and evil. I'm just saying they're always going to be on the edge.
Right.
You know, they're not a sexual person, and that's what makes them a femme fatale. They're not a mysterious person, that's what makes them a femme fatale. It's because of the mysterious, they're sexual, and they're on the edge.
And they're willing to use people.
Yeah. All right, so let's... cross that, you know, let's go over that edge to the antagonist. And why do you think, why would a femme fatale be a good antagonist to have in your game?
Because, like, speaking as a player who kind of interacted with one in a vampire game, because you sort of set up the side of my vampire character as sort of like a femme fatale, it's fun interacting with someone who you as a player don't know what their motivations are.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed that, and I think that's what having an antagonist or NPC femme fatale would bring to the game. And maybe not, you know, that might not be for everybody. Certain people would just want to know, no, I want to know what's going on. Where I thought the fun part was kind of not really knowing what's going on.
Right.
So
that gets into what you were saying, Chris, about, like, yeah, the mystery, and, like, definitely don't reveal. It's like, oh, this is a bad person, this is a villain. I think a femme fatale is all about the long game. To really get the enjoyment is to really drag that out.
And I think you did a good example of doing that in our vampire game, in just that my character was hearing lots of conflicting stories from NPCs about this femme fatale character. And I think that's one way a GM can maintain the mystery aspect is... The player characters are going to interact with NPCs. They're going to hear, you know, stories about this one character. Have them be conflicting, but have, whether they're true or not, it'll sort of keep the player characters guessing.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if those other NPCs telling the story are reliable.
Yeah.
You know, like we have no reason to distrust NPC A, and he's telling us this about the femme fatale character, but we also have no reason to distrust NPC B, and he's telling us a completely conflicting and different story.
Right.
So
absolutely, yeah.
We don't know who to believe.
And never be afraid to throw a wrench into it. Let him be completely manipulative. You know, if the PCs are going for a while and the femme fatale seems to be getting trustworthy, then throw in some evidence. They actually see her, you know, breaking into a shop and stealing something or doing something wrong.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. But then you can always flip it, and I think, like, for example, like the character in Changeling, one of the NPCs, where she came across as very unlikable. Then you find the story. And this is where the person being a victim, you see that being used. It's not, of course, the sexuality came later, but the entry point or the way to pierce the armor of the PCs can be the victim. It's like, well, you don't really know the real me. You don't know my story.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lay out a story, and you're like, Oh, I didn't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you're in the wrong. This person is the bad person. I thought that person was a good person. And, you know, kind of playing people off each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, and again, and making the lone lethal, that can, shake things up a bit in that people might expect a femme fatale because it's an iconic character, but they might not expect it from a man.
So. Yeah.
And if you have a female PC, then that person can come in and almost like a knight, you know, the white, you know, Prince Charming, but they're actually manipulating that particular person. Or if you have like gay PCs and things like that, yeah.
Yeah, I think this is a case where sort of if the femme fatale or homme fatale is going to be interacting with the PCs and kind of almost, it's not essentially like a love interest, but if you kind of have the Batman-Catwoman relationship going on with the PCs being Batman, essentially, kind of like we talked about in our romance episode, the PCs are going to have to be open to it.
Yeah.
Because I was actually thinking about Batman, like, he doesn't really seem to, whether he is or not, in my perception, doesn't really appear to be sexually attracted to Catwoman, you know, because
he is
fair enough. Yeah, but I mean, like, okay, maybe that's a bad example, but all right, it is a bad example, so scratch that. But I can see certain players just kind of shutting that down and saying, "No, I'm not going to interact with this person. I'm not going to do it."
So, I see what you're saying. Yeah,
go ahead and use that. I mean, it's like what you said a moment ago, Lyle. That if it's not working through one avenue, it's very realistic that they would go through the next avenue. You know, if one player rejects their advances, then break down crying. Oh my gosh, I'm so terrible at this. You know, play on whatever advantage you can to get that that player to fall into their hooks.
Yeah. So yeah, even if somebody's playing like the more stoic Batman, and the more chaste Batman, they would, you know, somebody being an orphan. Or, you know, telling the story about their parents getting killed by a criminal, that would, you know, you're forcing the player, because, and the player having backstory, manipulate that. You're forcing the player to then go, that is part of my backstory. Yeah.
And you kind of hope they would role play it.
Yeah.
Or,
don't care.
Almost like a, well, yeah, exactly like you said, Chris.
Yeah, cry me a river, you know, my parents died too, anyway.
Yeah, I guess essentially find that chink in the armor, and I guess I think an interesting sort of way to deal with that would then be, it sounds kind of strange, but would then be to go the friend route.
Yeah, I guess it's G-rated, but yeah, that's
a good one. I meant as a starting point.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's all it will be in a G-rated game or someone who's not interested in romance. But you could be, okay, so they rebuff the advances of this femme fatale character.
Yeah.
Okay, then you go the friend route and you use the backstory. Yeah, I'm an orphan too, or, you know, you find something like that.
Yeah, I think what you're referring to specifically is the Changeling campaign where my character rebuffed the advances of that femme fatale. But after that, the guilt of having done so was just as effective a tool.
Except you didn't go back.
Well, Chris's defense.
The game did end.
I was thinking about that. There's a character in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy who's kind of like omnisexual. I probably say bisexual, but omnisexual sounds a little bit cooler in this context.
Sounds jazzy or on the edge.
Jazzy, yeah. Sounds more edgy.
Extreme!
Yeah, okay, he was bisexual. So that gives the... gives them more options. I don't even know why I said omnisexual. What else was he having sex? So a person might have a pet. Use that. Sorry. I'm not saying bisexual people have sex with animals. Just getting that out there.
But omnisexual people too.
Yeah. Doesn't that sound a little bit edgier? A little bit more sexy?
Well, risque?
Yeah.
At first, yes, but when you go into the explanation of it, then it actually does sound like they're willing to have sex with anything.
It's like a joke. You explain it and it kind of falls flat.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's like those corporate buzzwords. You examine them, they really don't mean anything.
Just imagine first going, please stop. But I think that was a good example because, and you mentioned just about the friend route, and I was thinking, you know, something, kind of joke now, like a bromance, but sometimes you can have this where a person really, really, really likes a friend of the same sex. And it's like, it's beyond like a friendship. It's like a worship.
Soulmate.
Yeah, but it can be very, very one-sided. Jennifer's Body might be a good example of
although that did kind of have lesbian undertones.
But I did say bisexual. Mm. But there's a little bit of a hero worship, and then that can be used and manipulated. And yeah, Jennifer's Body, I didn't want to use Megan Fox's character as an example because I think it was too much of a killer aspect.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were certain things that she does that are very femme fatale-like. You know, using her sexuality with someone who's probably straight, but worships her so much that, you know, it is an entry point.
Yeah.
And we should say, we forgot to mention this earlier, but we don't consider a femme fatale like somebody who's an assassin. Like, La Femme Nikita has aspects of a femme fatale, but she's pretty much just an assassin.
Right.
Yeah. So that is just a tool in order to achieve her end result. So.
Yeah.
And I think that's okay. Like, play an assassin, a male-female assassin with some, you know, femme fatale or homme fatale aspects, but it's not the real thing.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, it's like we said before, you know, people and manipulation is the weapon of the femme fatale, whereas an assassin, it's poison or something.
Right.
Yeah. Although poison is also the weapon of the femme fatale.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, I guess.
Sleeping gas.
Thanks for shooting that down, Miles.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's kind of hard to find out where that.
Oh, wait a minute. That shut down my point, too. Oh, forget it. Yeah, La Femme Nikita. Great. Yeah, forgot to mention her.
I was going to say, I think it's kind of hard to find where that line is, but I guess it seems to me like for assassins, the seduction is almost a distraction.
Yeah.
For like the poison or the bullet or whatever.
An ends to a mean.
Yeah, it's more like the tool the ends to a mean, where the femme fatale, it's kind of, that's your only tool.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say necessarily only. One of the things I was looking up was about how to write femme fatales in a character, and a guy writing the blog gave advice to say, give them a special skill. And it can be fighting, or it can be oratory, or acting, or acrobatics, or dance, or something like that. But something to set them out from the rest of the crowd. If you're in a room, a party full of beautiful women, this one has to be special for some reason. So it's not to say that they aren't able to hold a weapon or do something like that, but make sure that it's not the thing they do.
I think that's a good point about having something to stand out. Again, I shy away maybe from being a supreme fighter.
The combat monster.
But yeah, if you were in, like, imagine the femme fatale would stand out in a room full of models. Whether or not she looks like a model herself, or whether or not he looks like a model, in that there is something about them, you know. So you have powerful men and women being attracted to them because they offer them a little bit more, you know. Oh, I can talk to her.
Right.
Yeah. You know, she's engaging. Oh, she doesn't want me. She's playing, you know. Mm. Yeah. There is a little something more. And they do stand out, and they have character. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking that goes way back to kind of what we said about Mata Hari, and she wasn't known as like a classic beauty, but there was something interesting about her that kind of raised her above everything else. In this case, it was dancing with
the willingness to do anything.
Yeah, the willingness to do anything with practically no clothes on. But
I think it was the syphilis. She had that little something special.
Or that.
Jeez, dude.
But I would say it almost, I'm not disagreeing with that blog up, but I would almost say it doesn't even have to be a skill. As Lyle said, there just has to be something interesting.
I think it's a nice mechanical suggestion.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
Yeah, as a mechanic.
Right.
But just going to somebody who is kind of the sexy assassin, I think a lot of people might find that easier to play. And I think that would be easier to fit into a lot of games because you don't have to have a lot of overt sexuality in a game where the person is La Femme Nikita.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is because, put in that little black dress and she'll get through the guards and then she'll, like, you know, shoot him in the back of the head with a silencer.
Right.
But so that's, I think, would be easier. And maybe that character can then transform into a true femme fatale in time as people become more comfortable with that character and more comfortable with those storylines. And then you start to manipulate your backstory. I think La Femme Nikita has the type of backstory that lends itself to a femme fatale, you know, a bit of a victim and certainly a need for revenge, you know. I just start to de-emphasizing the gun stuff.
It also depends on the campaign you're running too, because if you're doing a fantasy or D&D style thing, it's hard to get through without some kind of abilities like that.
Seduce that dragon.
Well, good thing dragons can polymorph into human. Let's hope he does it.
Ah, there you go. That would be a way. I mean, I think that's you just threw that out there. But yeah, that's a good way for a game master to play along.
Yeah.
Somebody's playing this character. Everybody's really enjoying this character. You want to have a dragon because, you know, it's fantasy and you've played like a couple of adventures now and you haven't had any iconic characters. Something like that. Damn, she manipulates this dragon through the, you know, dragons polymorphed or whatever. And now play that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or like we said before, you know, just go for another aspect. Dragons like gold, as we heard earlier.
So what, dragons like women?
Well, no, promise him riches.
I ain't saying she's a gold digger. But she ain't messing with no broke dragons.
That horde is way too small.
That what is
horde?
Like...
Horde.
Oh, okay.
Jeez. Take a polymorph to a whole new level.
All right. Sorry.
Stop bringing up Janet Jackson.
Sorry.
Oh, my Lord.
Well, that ends Creature Femme Fatale, and I hope you guys got excited listening to this as we got... Okay, I'm not going to...
Yeah. I got excited!
I'm not going to finish that.
You know what? Wait. You know what? I got excited for the Om Fatale.
Yeah.
That's something cool. About him just stands out. Gee, I wonder what it is.
I know it's the omnisexual thing that got to me.
Anything, really? I guess a better way to put it is I hope that certain things we said may made you want to include a femme fatale either as a protagonist or an antagonist in your game. Or, of course, like playing the male version of that, which is, I guess, less iconic, but still very possible.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. You can listen to the episodes right there on the website or download it through DriveThruRPG, listen to it on Stitcher, or stream it through iTunes. You can post in our forums, see us on Twitter, through Facebook, or just send us an email, because we always love hearing from all of you guys. Thanks, and see you next time.
Bye.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.